going to see if we can stop fearing failure this hour. Does the fear of failure stop you from trying something? Do you anguish over past failures? Can we redefine failure in our culture as something that is a part of life, something to be expected, not the end of the world? I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We welcome your stories about past failures that really weren't failures. We will welcome your thoughts about whether we should erase the word failure from our vocabulary, from education, from society. Was there a time when you did not succeed at something the way you envisioned, but it helped you try something else or try again? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. We have with us the co-authors of the new book, Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. Shelley DeVito is a teacher, internationally acclaimed author, and trained facilitator in restorative practice. She runs workshops internationally on the impact of and management of stress at home, in the workplace, and in the classroom. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Paul Williams is an award-winning author of several books. He coordinates the creative writing program at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia. He also graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee with his PhD. Paul and Shelley are co-authors of the book Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. So, let's see, Shelley, first, why are we so afraid of failure?
Yeah, well, I suppose it goes back to prehistoric times when our mammal brains, you know, drive us towards the taste of success. And so our so-called failures paralyze us because we're wired to avoid all the things that cause disappointment. But unfortunately, these days, we tie that instinct to avoid disappointment to all kinds of things, you know, from the upcoming test to the fact that I didn't get the raise in my new job and, you know, all those things. And so we're actually having a prehistoric reaction to a current situation, and they don't really match very well.
And Paul, is our fear of failure getting worse?
Yes, I think it's ratcheting up because we have this notion of success, and in the book we talk about failure as quite a recent concept in terms of talking of people as failures, and the more we market, think about failure, the more we fear it, and then it just becomes a cycle.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong, Paul, with us, being reluctant to fail, to fear failure?
What's wrong with us fearing failure? Well, failure is a good thing, as Shelley was saying. It's a good thing because it's like a fight or flight response. Failure often will propel us to succeed, but of course, we can get into the cycle where failure is going to defeat us, and the idea of failure. It's such a small-minded concept that's become, and it's constructed, but it's become so big in our lives.
Yeah, in the book, you break down failure into three categories, first, second, and third degree. Shelley, you want to explain these categories in more detail?
Yeah, one of the things that we face, one of the problems, is that we use failure as this blanket term. And that's really confusing because, of course, not all failures were created equal. And so first-degree failures we've defined as those failures that result in total disasters, you know, airplanes that fail to arrive at their destination, emergency services that fail to arrive on time to save somebody, and failures that have irredeemable results. People die and things are damaged. And the only thing that we can do with those failures is try to stop them from ever happening again. Second degree failures are those failures we've defined as those where we set goals but we don't meet them. So we try to get to the top of Everest and we don't, but we come back alive anyway. Or, you know, Apollo 13 tries to get to the moon and it doesn't, but everybody comes back alive and they learn some amazing things along the way. And then third degree failures are the ones we decide are failures. So those are quite subjective and random. And those are the kinds of failures that we say a pass mark for this exam is 50%. And then if we get 49, we feel terrible about ourselves. But we're the ones who designed the pass mark at 50%. And so we randomly impose parameters on those, or financial parameters or academic. You know, if I don't get that, if I don't get my degree, then I'm a failure. If I don't get that job, I'm a failure. So those are third degree failures, and those we can completely really eliminate because we make them ourselves, so we can unmake them.
Yeah. So I talk a little bit more, though, Shelley, about whether, I mean, we certainly do want to avoid the failure that's going to result in people dying. So that is a failure that we want to avoid at all costs. And the others, though, you're saying are maybe they're not. Those are not the end of the world.
Yeah, exactly. So first degree failures are true failures in terms of the word, meaning that you don't get to where you're going at all. It results in a total disaster. And those really are failures. But the other two, second-degree failures, our lives are full of them. Life is a journey of second-degree failures. We most often have unexpected outcomes to things that we strive for. So often things don't go as planned. And our third-degree failures are absolutely part of our construct of our society. We've created a ladder of success. And all the books on success are about, you know, how you, if you do it right, if you just put your mind to it, you can reach the top. But so often we don't, but we've made the top. So it's really our construct of the ladder that we are caught in. And so, yeah, we're saying that those two categories can be changed. We can change the way we see them and perhaps change our quality of life if we do that.
Yeah. And Paul, how might that change the quality of our life?
Well, the fact that, I mean, it takes up so much of our life. So I suppose it acceptance of what life is about, because we often fail, it's big, but we deny it, and we deny its presence. So to actually accept that there is such a thing as failure, and we will fail, and we'll fail often, we can relax about it in a sense. We can. We talk a lot in the book about imperturbability, just not being so riled by failure or beating ourselves up so much when it happens, because it's going to happen, and it could be first, second, or third degree failure. And just how to deal with this and how to accept this is, like, you know, our key to survival, basically.
And the book's title, Fail Brilliantly. Shelley, how do you fail brilliantly?
You live your life with both, you know, with both hands open, and you live your life fully, because a life fully lived is a brilliant failure. We all, I'm going to sound morbid here, we all end in failure. One day we fail to get up in the morning. Yeah. And so if we want to live brilliantly, we're going to have to fail brilliantly. We're going to have to accept that life will not go in an expected way, that we'll all be faced with first degree, second degree, and third degree failures. We will all encounter those along the way. And so to really fail brilliantly, we just have to live brilliantly and in the moment and confront those things, which is part of most of life, which we call failures. We will lose people, we will lose jobs, we will lose things and houses and friends. And how we deal with that is much more important than whether it happens or not, because guaranteed it will. So we love the quote by Lionel Shriver where she says there are so many self-help books on how to succeed, but she says she's never come across a single one on how to contend with not succeeding. And she says that's pretty much the form for practically everybody. And so we really took that up as a challenge and thought, yes, That's exactly right.
Well, we'll talk more about how we can contend with not succeeding. How should we react to not succeeding, to our so-called failures? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So how have you learned to overcome what you deem to be your personal failures? What have you learned from your failures? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. We are talking with Shelley DeVito and Paul Williams, co-authors of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. We'll check news and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Harvey remains a tropical storm over southeast Texas, dumping heavy rains and causing widespread flooding. In the Houston area, reservoirs are releasing water to prevent massive flooding in the city's downtown. Water rescues continue. The National Weather Service says more than 2 feet of rain have fallen since Harvey came ashore on Friday night as a Category 4 hurricane. Another 2 feet of rain are possible before the week is over. Craig Cummings with the Texas Department of Public Safety says dealing with a disaster this size is requiring a huge effort.
Helicopters to boats to troopers to emergency management professionals to try to manage this disaster as best as possible.
At least 2 deaths are blamed on Harvey. The federal government says some serious cases of abuse in nursing homes are not being reported to police as required by law. NPR's Ina Jaffe says investigators looked at 33 states.
Federal investigators found 134 cases of abuse serious enough to send nursing home residents to the emergency room. 28% of these cases were not reported to police. This is only a preliminary report. Next, investigators want to see if the nursing homes where the abuse took place were penalized in any way.
The findings come from the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 6:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Governor Scott Walker and Republican lawmakers have different ideas on how to pay for education under the next budget. As Danielle Kading reports, smaller districts support the governor's proposal, while low-spending districts favor the legislature's plans.
Right now, some districts that spend the least amount of money on students are falling behind with rising costs and no additional support from taxpayers. But the Senate and Assembly have put forth plans to allow low-spending districts to raise revenues. Matt Spetz with Howard Suamico School District says that would allow them to raise money through property taxes without voter approval.
We could restore some of the cuts we've had to make because of the frozen revenue limit ceiling over the last few years. So it'd be really exciting to add some teachers to some classrooms that are overcrowded.
Districts like Howard Suamico hope lawmakers' plans will allow them to be more competitive with districts that have more money, but they wouldn't be able to see additional revenue without a referendum under Governor Scott Walker's proposed budget. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
One person has died and 4 others are injured after a 2-vehicle crash in Outagamie County last week. One of the 4 injured includes a sheriff's deputy. Authorities say a car failed to yield at a stop sign intersection in Black Creek and hit the deputy's squad car. A 94-year-old passenger in the car was flown to the hospital where he died. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
We are talking with the co-authors of the new book, Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. And we are welcoming your examples of times when you failed brilliantly. How did you respond to what you perceived to be a failure? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Today's society places high stakes on being successful, and this in turn has created a culture that fears failure, according to our guests. And our guests are discussing how we can redefine failure and see it as an essential aspect of our lives rather than something to be afraid of. And again, we welcome your thoughts, your questions, your examples for both of our guests, Shelley DeVito, who is a co-author, along with Paul Williams, the book Fail Brilliantly. We have a number of people on Facebook who have mentioned, Michelle on Facebook says, I think we fail every day and some of us realize or notice it and become a better person next time. Michael on Facebook says, many lessons may be learned from failure, more lessons probably than from success. Paul, how do you react to that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're saying, is that by embracing it, we realize that it's not the negative. I mean, of course it's negative, and that's the idea of failing brilliantly. There's that contradiction. Of course it's a negative concept, and we can never erase that. But we can use that failure as a stepping stone for growth. All our scientific discoveries arise out of 1,000 failures first, and then we get to somewhere. So I agree totally. I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah.
Understand the inevitability.
What Shelley, are some of the potential consequences of being deemed a failure?
Well, we develop low self-esteem. We really crush ourselves. We end up fighting with other people because we're trying to get to the top of a pile. So it results in a lot of self-esteem issues, and that has repercussions everywhere, in our homes, in our workplaces, and it's all because of a paradigm, of a construct. We live in this world of failure and success, and so when we're not succeeding, we are failing, and therefore we seek to blame ourselves or we seek to blame others, and of course that's non-productive no matter which way you look at it.
Yeah. Gary on Facebook says, I think I would rather have a brilliant success. Although it often takes several failures until you get something right, those failures still cost time and usually money. Getting it right the first time can be an even better learning experience. What about that, Paul?
Yeah, of course. But we don't often... How do we get something right the first time? We always have to learn, and we learn by our mistakes. We learn the hard way. Often a success is a fluke. It's something that we practice. If you want to be good at something, we have to practice and practice and practice. And, of course, if we get it right the first time, that's wonderful, but then we don't know how we got there. So maybe we need to – it's a path of development, I think.
Yeah,
I'd love to fail successfully.
Well, you know, I guess I'm thinking maybe what Gary is saying is that before you say, you know what, I'm going to open up a business that's going to save the world, that you do a little bit of homework first, and you would, you don't just you look before you leap, I think, is what Gary's saying. Are you saying that we should just leap before we and think the net will catch us?
No, I think it's we try. It's sort of built into the world. That's the way it works, is that, you know, of course we need to try our best not to fail. We're not deliberately going out to fail, but it seems to be part of our process of life.
Do you want to weigh in, Shelley?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would have taken us maybe 5 minutes instead of 4 billion years to get to where we are today if there weren't, you know, a whole process of trials and errors. So it looks like that process that's taken 4 billion years to get us to where we are today will continue into the foreseeable future. So I think these successes are wonderful. And as Malcolm Gladwell said in his book Outliers, you put in your 10,000 hours and then you need a lucky break. And some people do get lucky breaks, but most of us actually don't get that lucky break. And so what happens when you don't get it? If obviously we all would rather get it, but so many of us don't, that we have to acknowledge that that's the majority of the population, and we want to find a way for the majority of the population to live happier, more fulfilling lives instead of chasing that elusive dream of one day making it to the very top.
Yeah. So, all right. For example, Shelley, let's say we want to climb Mount Everest, and we keep on failing at that. That just as a hypothetical example. How do we cope with that failure?
That's a great question, and it's a good metaphor for everything in life, because life is like Mount Everest, and we do want to get to the top, and so we try, and then we try again, and even if we don't make it, does that mean that every single trip is worthless? Or the fact that we die at the end of our lives, does that make our lives meaningless? I don't think so. So therefore, the destination is not as important as the journey. And maybe along the way up Mount Everest, we've met some incredible people, we've tested our physical strength, we've found out that we can survive with very little oxygen. Maybe we've learned a whole lot of things, and that in itself is a success. It's of value. So I suppose I'd like to replace this idea of success with something of value, because then you don't have the end game in sight all the time. You've actually got the process, the journey, as the thing that has value. And so if you don't ever make it to the top of Mount Everest, so what? What other wonderful things did you find along the way? Yeah. If I never make $1 billion, does that mean that all my efforts are meaningless? I'd like to think not.
Yeah. We are talking with the co-authors of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. We're talking about how we can redefine failure and how we can see failure as an essential part of our lives rather than something to be afraid of. What do you think? What questions do you have? What examples do you have, perhaps, of times that you did not succeed the way you thought you wanted to succeed at something? What happened next? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with Shelley DeVito and Paul Williams, co-authors of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. In the book, Paul, you talk about the myth of academic failure. Why do you call that a myth?
Well, that's because it's a third-degree failure. And as Shelley was saying, we construct these benchmarks that we are meant to reach. And I suppose we're moving away from this idea of this examination that everything hinges on reaching one grade or getting to a certain point, because education and academic success is not based on one result, but it's based on the things we learn along the way. And so I suppose the way that we learn is not linear. As we learn sideways, and we talk about unexpected outcomes of trying something and saying, oh, look at this is what's happening. These other things are happening too. So we can learn in a multi-directional way rather than in one linear way getting to one result.
Yeah. Are you, Shelley, advocating that we get rid of the F grade or the pass-fail concept?
I would love that. I think that would benefit everybody. I don't think anyone would suffer from that, and this may be controversial, but there are schools across America, and there are some schools in Australia where we are right now, where they have managed to eliminate A to F grades, and that doesn't seem to have any negative impact on what students achieve. In fact, because there's no ceiling and there's no floor through which you fall into some dark trapdoor existence, because that's been taken away, students seem to thrive and to reach and excel. And so when you do then have to take a test, you realize that you've got an enormous body of knowledge. And students from those colleges, universities, schools often go on to, you know, study medicine and do things that are extremely high powered, even though they haven't been through the grading factory. So I think we are moving in that direction because grades have not served us well. Standardized tests just standardize everything. They're not necessarily the way the future needs to go. So I think if we eliminated failure from schools, for example, that would have an enormous impact on the well-being and actual success of students, because so often it's the fear of failure. The fear of an F grade is so enormous, it's almost like we've tied our entire neurobiological survival to a grade. And when our kids don't get their A's, as parents, we get stressed because, you know, we want the best for them, but then we've tied that to a grade, which somehow means survival, whereas we've got enough proof that that doesn't mean survival at all necessarily. It just means you're good at taking tests. So I think it would be great to get rid of grades. I'll be the first to advocate for that.
Yeah, and you would too, Paul?
Yes, I think, where I'm teaching, we've done away with grades, and we're talking about learning journeys, and people learn in different ways. They learn at different levels, different speeds, and I suppose accommodating what their strengths are, rather than having one particular goal for all of them. So, I agree. Of course, it's not going to happen anytime soon, because that's how we think. We like to categorize people as well, but the idea I was like a C student for a lot of, and you start to see yourself as a failure. You say, I'm a failure. I'm always this, and you perpetuate this failure on yourself, and other people will again label you. And so that became very destructive. And I think getting out of that pattern and having to retell the story, and we talk about a narrative of failure, of how we tell ourselves these stories. We can change the story, and this is one way of changing the story.
Yeah. So it sounds quite attractive, but what about the bar? Doesn't there have to be some sort of bar for kids in particular? If they're not grasping a concept, do we just want to move them on in school, or do we want to hold them back?
Well, if you have a linear model, then you're in trouble. But if you don't, for example, Finland's schooling system, which has no grades and no tests until quite a lot later, especially in grade school, there are no tests and there's no high-stakes testing at all. And there are very, very high standards that the kids are held accountable to. But all that information, any kind of assessment, is held by the teachers, so that information is kept, and it's for the teachers to improve their teaching rather than to tell the kids to learn better or learn harder. So it's for the teachers to evolve, to meet the students where they're at and move them on to the next level. So the learning progressions are all very much there. They're just not necessarily, the kids are not labeled and they're not put in on a ladder, and that enables them to thrive. And so over the last decade or so, the PISA tests, which are international benchmark tests, which test all ninth graders in several countries across the world, Finland has come out tops over several years, and they have nothing like the grading systems in the States or in Australia. And so that really does tell us something, that perhaps we are running headlong into the wrong direction. And it's time to turn around. And some people are turning around. Some school districts are turning around. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I do too. And I wonder what our listeners think. What do you think of this idea of eliminating the concept of failure from education? Should we get rid of that pass-fail thing? Should we get rid of letter grades? Should we not flunk students? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with the co-authors of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success, Shelley DeVito and Paul Williams. They're joining us from Australia. They did, though, spend time in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. Paul is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Let's go to, we have lots of calls coming in now who want to weigh in on that, but I have Alicia on Facebook says, I left retail work because I burned out. I went into manufacturing. That wasn't any better. Now I'm going back to school. So, Shelley, how does that, I mean, I guess Alicia's saying that she's, she so-called failed at retail and manufacturing, and now she wants to find something else. Is that an example of not fearing failure?
It's brilliant. I think that's wonderful. What a wonderful thing to do, to have as many lives as possible packed into one. And I think, I'm sure all the things, all the journeys in those previous two employments had valuable things to offer, and now it's time for a new direction. So I applaud that. I think that's wonderful.
Brendan from Winona, Minnesota wants to know, what are the potential downsides of hoping for the best but expecting the worst? Do you have an answer to that, Paul?
There's a chapter on the philosophy of failure where we look at various philosophies of how people see failure and success, and the idea of actually, could you give that question again?
Oh, sorry. I think Brendan wanted to know if there was a downside to hoping for the best but expecting the worst.
Well, of course, because expecting the worst, then you're going to be pessimistic. But in a way, I wrote about this philosophy where if you expect the worst, then things can only get better. But in terms of not expecting it in terms of a negative way, but see, this is part of life. We are going to fail, so we can expect it. But that's not going to make us drop even further. It makes us more determined to carry on.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will take your calls, full lines now, with people with questions or examples of failing brilliantly. We are talking with the co-authors of the book Fail Brilliantly. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about success and failure with two guests who say we should redefine failure, and we should see it as an essential aspect of our lives. We should redefine it and not consider so-called failure the end of the world. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. Is it a necessary part of life? Is it a concept that really isn't all that bad? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you can share with us some of your failures that really weren't failures. Maybe you tried again. Maybe you did accomplish a lot as you were on that endeavor. While you may not have reached the ultimate goal, you still achieved a lot. Are you successful now because you weren't in the traditional sense of the word successful at something in the past? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guests are Shelley DeVito and Paul Williams. They are co-authors of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. Let's go to Katie in Fall Creek. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to talk about, I'm a ninth grade advisor through an online school in the state of Wisconsin, and I work with a lot of students who are quote-unquote failures, and I work with them a lot in terms of improving what I call their human skills. So soft skills and like 21st century skills. But I also work with them in terms of reflection and how important it is that if they do fail or if they do have an issue with a class or in school, that they're thinking about why it happened and then trying to fix it if they can. And if they can't, then find someone who can help them grow their skills so that they can be better and they can learn.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie. What do you make of that that concept, Shelley?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I think focusing on the development of soft skills is not just good for those kids we term failures, but for everybody, because in the 21st century, in a very short while, most jobs that we do, which we can't even imagine yet because they don't exist, will require those soft skills. And I think what you're saying is absolutely right about building the skills when you don't have them, and but not attaching your own personal value to how fast and how far you go with those skills. Just making sure that you're scaffolding them and you're building on them, and you're feeling that that the student is actually feeling, yeah, I'm getting this. I've got this now, and now I can move on to the next step without feeling like if I don't get it by tomorrow, I am a total failure. So that sounds really wonderful. It sounds like a great program that you're running there.
Thank you, Katie. Mike in Madison is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning. Hey, first off, I wanted to say, Joy, I was incredibly sad to hear that you're leaving at the end of September.
Aw,
you make my morning drives way more exciting.
Well, I'm. Thank you for the kind words, Mike, and I look forward to staying for the next month or so. But yes, in case listeners are wondering, I did announce recently that I will retire at the end of September, and I look forward to listening, and rather than getting up and as early as I do to host. Thanks very much, Mike. What is your thought on success and failure?
I think part of my problem is the way the discussion is approached a lot of times. I think when we say we don't want to have failure in school, I think a lot of people get defensive and say, oh, what are we going to do? Are we just going to coddle the kids? We're not going to, teach them. They're never going to learn about real life because real life has a lot of failure. That's one thing. It's one thing to not succeed at a thing or fail at something, but it's another thing to, especially in the system that we have right now, we label children with failure. We call them a failure. We put them in remedial classes. We separate them out from everybody else, and we really kind of make them outsiders. And then that label persists through their entire career. Both the educational system and their classmates then start treating them that way. So when we start labeling them as a failure, that's kind of the basis of the problem.
Thank you, Mike. I heard you say yes, Shelley.
Oh, absolutely. I think Mike's just hit the nail on the head, because that's exactly what we do, and that's exactly what we believe anyway is part of the problem that we're facing. It's got nothing to do with the idea of not having failure. Has nothing to do with the idea of not getting things wrong. We get things wrong all the time, and I'd love to just use pilot training as an analogy, because our 20-year-old son has just completed a pilot training, and when you watch how that training works, so much of it is based on, can you do this yet? Are you safe to go in the skies yet? So there are exams, but a lot of it is practical. And so as you learn to do things, you are allowed to then go solo. You don't want someone flying a plane who doesn't know how to do it. So it's really, it's not so much about failure or success. It's that, can you do it or not yet? And I think if we had that pilot training approach to schools and education, Mike's advocating for us seeing things differently is right on target, because then we might just have, can you do this or not yet? Do you need some more time, some more help, some more support? Do you need another way of looking at things? Because eventually you will get there too. So, that's what I'd like to encourage in terms of how we think about it.
Yeah. Now, Paul, would you like to add in?
Yeah, I was going to say that same thing about we're not there yet. And it's almost like being wrong is a key to our growth. And that's how we should look at failure. And that, oh, you've tried this, and let's see why it doesn't work, and let's see what we can do about it, rather than being put in a box and saying, well, we're failures. And that's a very static concept. So
right.
This idea of that it's a growth opportunity.
How about Mike's, he was conveying the attitude that some have, that we're coddling kids and we're not preparing them for the inevitable failures that they are going to they're going to find in life. Are we coddling kids if we don't,
I think it's the opposite. I think because we're screening them from what happens in real life. We fail, but we have to deal with that failure rather than just saying, oh, well, we failed and other people are better than us. So this idea of coddling, it's more like if we can nourish students and enable them to fail and to learn what to do with failure, then they'll be better. I think they'll be better at dealing with failure in real life.
Yeah, a lot of our...
Yeah, I'd love to add to that.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Shelley.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, now I'd love to add to that in that when you have students who are allowed to try things out more than one time without getting an F, how wonderful is that? Because not only will you find the 10,000 ways that things don't work, you might discover things that you didn't intend to discover at the beginning. And how many of some of the world's greatest discoveries came out of accidents while people were looking for something else? One of the things we mentioned is Viagra, which was a complete, it was just an anomaly that they were looking for something for angina and heart issues and came out with Viagra. So that's just a humorous way of how a failure actually led to success that made millions of people very happy.
We need to have
more of that attitude. Let's find the 10,000 things that don't work, and then let's give it a chance to, and then let's give something completely unexpected a chance to emerge. So that would be a wonderful way of looking at things, not coddling kids at all or people.
Yeah, let's go to Kathy in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I wanted to share. I'm a consultant, and I consult with schools across the state of Wisconsin. And our schools across the state are adopting two things and working really hard and quite successfully at implementing them. The first is looking at school culture and understanding now that it's the culture for achievement that sets the table for the great instructional practices that our teachers do have. And the other part that they're implementing is what's termed in education as a growth mindset, which is exactly what your guest was talking about. Are you ready yet? Do you have this yet? So I think great things are still coming and building upon the great things we have in our schools in Wisconsin.
Thank you, Kathy. So, Paul, you can react to that, and I wonder if you think great things are coming.
Yeah, well, I think this is exactly what's happening. I think we're realizing that binary idea of fail and success is so static that we need to start thinking in contextual ways. And that idea that you're talking about, the culture of the school and this growth mindset, that sounds exactly where we're going. I think as we're realizing that we're not aiming for one particular goal or one particular job, that we need, as Shelley was saying, we need to be allowed to fail or have that space to fail. And we have where I teach, we have a course where we don't have grades because we're expecting them to fail. We said, try this, push this as hard as you can, see where you get with it. And then it also empowers students to take control, say, wow, we're discovering things this way. So in terms of that, I agree in terms of it's a cultural shift that's happening.
Yeah, we've been talking quite a bit about education and eliminating the concept of failure from education. What are the benefits of eliminating the concept of failure from society in general, from human endeavor in general, Shelley?
That would be really wonderful. I think that would eliminate lots of depression because we've also set ourselves on a trajectory of success, and success in a very narrow definition. So success in terms of financial gains and stuff, just collecting stuff. And I suppose if we can get away from that, the idea that the guy with the most toys at the end, who dies with the most toys at the end, is the winner, then we might be able to find more value in the everyday little things that we do rather than chasing this elusive thing that we call success. By the way, all the books written about success are by highly successful people, and they make up such a small percentage of the general population. And then we all buy into that, and we think, oh, if I do what he did or she did, the same thing will happen to me. And if we can somehow get away from that very narrow little box that we've put ourselves in, we might be able to see life much more, as I said before, as a journey rather than this race to the top of the pile that we may never meet. And if we took away that idea of, oh, I failed to get to the top of the mountain, perhaps we would be able to find value in things that otherwise we don't value because they're not part of the success strategy or they don't lead us to the top of the mountain.
This has been very interesting.
Very beneficial.
Yeah, thank you very much, both of you, for being with us. We're out of time for now. Shelley DeVito and Paul Williams, co-author of Fail Brilliantly, Exploding the Myths of Failure and Success. Thanks to producer August Brown. August, our summer intern, this is her last day today. Thanks very much, August, for all of your work. With help from Brianne Chasseau and Dinesha Ellison. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.